Tonight we're going to review part of Volume 4, While Venerable Children's Traveling. We'll be looking at Chapter 6. So by way of motivation, I'll just share a short poem and then a reworking of it on the Four Immeasurables. And this first one's by John Agarbha. And he said, "On the well-prepared ground of equanimity, the flowers of love are scattered. They are embellished with the shade of compassion and purified by the clear waters of joy." And then Longchenpa wrote his own verses, kind of a takeoff on that. And he said, "Thus a person, by having taken refuge, has become the site for spiritual growth, will cultivate their mind for the welfare of those who are alive. By letting the flower of compassion blossom in the soil of love and tending it with the pure water of equanimity in the cool shade of joyfulness." So may we, by our efforts during this retreat and what little we can do this evening in terms of learning about serenity, develop minds that are capable of these four immeasurables without so much hindrance. And may we do this so that we can actually embody these beautiful aspirations, these beautiful states of mind, and hold people with these sentiments. And may we make this part of our path to full awakening, remembering that's our ultimate goal, to alleviate all suffering by becoming awakened. Can't see through the mic. So I'm doing Chapter 6, which is the first chapter where we're starting on the far-reaching attitude of concentration. And the more chapters go into that. But by way of introduction, I wanted to take one section of the book and put it at the beginning, because I find this to be what my mind needs. And I used some ideas from Lama Tsongkhapa, but they're pretty much the same as what was in the chapter. And he talks about what you have to do prior to focusing your attention on the object of meditation. And I found this quite helpful, especially because I've not really worked on concentration that much the last few years because my mind was too busy with this building. And I usually do work a lot on concentration, and so I found these words particularly helpful. And he said, "From the onset, stop the laziness," or what Alan Wallace calls the spiritual sloth, "of being reluctant or unwilling to cultivate concentration, enjoying things that are not conducive to it, or you will not attain concentration. And even if you have, you won't retain it." And it's very easy to kind of find other things to do, I find. So Lama Tsongkhapa says it's crucial to stop this at the beginning. And he says, by repeatedly cultivating faith or confidence, which is what I'm going to explain next, when you see this process in practice, you will understand the most vital point with the clearest sense of certainty. And the process he's talking about here is how we look at these benefits of concentration and get ourselves to do this, get over the laziness. So I'm going to work from back to the causes, from the results. You have concentration and actually have serenity once you have pliancy. So pliancy, I want to sell you on. I love pliancy. I found this, the thought of it, I find invigorating. I've loved it since the first time I ever read about it. And I remember when Geshe Tekchok was here, we asked him about it, and Venerable thought I was nuts. But I'm still like, I like this topic. Because it helps you. Once you have pliancy, your body and mind are serviceable. And it stops the laziness that gets in the way. You're able to cultivate virtue all day and night without weariness. And actually, you're able to get over these dysfunctions mentally and physically that get in the way. Like the physical dysfunctions we have, these are considered in the class of afflictions, and they interfere with us decreasing our afflictions. The body can feel heavy rather than feeling buoyant. And the mind, these mental dysfunctions, they also get in the way. We can't experience pleasure when we're decreasing the afflictions because we have so much resistance. And we just imagine those things being gone. The body is just like buoyant, ready to go, and the mind is having no resistance. And you're just, you know. So to develop this pliancy, you have to have enthusiasm for concentration, because actually that's how you develop it, is concentration brings about the pliancy. But you need continuous enthusiasm. And that's by doing that continuously, you will develop pliancy. So you have to take delight in making continuous effort. So you have to really like doing concentration meditation without any hesitation. So to develop this enthusiasm, you need a strong aspiration that seeks meditative concentration. That's what leads to having the enthusiasm. So this aspiration is like a yearning that's intent on concentration. And the cause of that is a stable faith that's captivated by seeing the qualities of meditative concentration. And so when I think about this now, because I have liked this topic for a long time, I see this in a different way. When they say captivated or fascinated with the good qualities, they're not talking about in your head. They're not talking about you read this list and you think it's pretty cool. They're talking about when you're sitting on the cushion, you're captivated by what you're doing, because you know these qualities are developing. So I think that, like Venerable Khadro said a few weeks ago, when she worked on serenity, she had to really get like fascinated with it. I can't remember the word she used, but you got to get into it. Buddhaghosa talks about the cause of concentration and serenity being bliss. You want to hold your mind on something. You're taking delight in doing it. So the way we develop this confidence and fascination with these good qualities, we do this by looking at the qualities and developing this faith that's stable by we see these qualities. So this is why Tsongkhapa says, when you see this process in practice, you understand this most vital point with the clearest sense of certainty. So we have to see this for ourselves. And we can see this from the beginning to a degree, from any kind of improvements that we make, as long as we kind of take time to see that and see that we are getting some profit by what we're doing. So what are the good qualities or the benefits of concentration? In this chapter, Venerable talked about six of them. The first one is, once you reach serenity, your mind, because of the pliancy, your mind, when you first reach serenity and this pliancy occurs, your mind is filled with delight or joy and your body is filled with bliss, and you immediately become very comfortable. And then as you develop it further, it's not quite so agitated, you might say. It's more peaceful. So then your body and mind are very peaceful. So that makes you quite happy in this lifetime. So that's one thing. Another benefit is that once you have this physical and mental pliancy of serenity, then you can turn your attention to whatever you want, to any virtuous object of meditation. And this, by being able to do that, this facilitates being able to understand the meaning of these objects and integrate these meanings into your mind. It makes your mind more powerful. And then the third is that all of our virtuous activities become more focused, and so they then have a stronger effect. We're not like doing the next thing, which is this distraction. You know, like we're not on automatic. So our virtuous conduct then is much more powerful. And the involuntary distraction is much less. So we're not so much distracted to mistaken objects that then cause us to have poor conduct, faulty conduct. So then we don't do so many things that get in the way, you know, of our ethical conduct. So this is a great benefit to be able to direct and have more control of your mind. That's how I would think of it. And then it's also serenity is the basis for mastery over the external elements. And Venerable talked about these as the supernormal powers. This example, these are part of the superknowledges. Serenity helps to actualize the superknowledges, which expand our range of experiential knowledge. And she had talked about these in previous books, I think maybe volume 2 or something. So she doesn't go into it much in this chapter, and we're not going to tonight. But those are useful, and even Atisha talks about how we need these super knowledges so that we can benefit beings. That's how Jeffrey got that book, Walking Through Walls. The title used to be Walking Through Walls. And then the sixth one, and in some sense the most important, it's on the basis of serenity that we can develop insight into the nature of reality, and also that we actualize the stages of Tantra to full awakening. So by these two things, we can cut the root of cyclic existence, and we can become fully awakened. So we need serenity to do those things. So we reflect on these qualities in order to strengthen our inclination to develop concentration. And we have to do this in such a way that it's coming from the inside. We're prompting ourselves from within. So I want to ask the question that I put out. I said the question is this. We may not have done a serenity retreat, what benefits have you experienced from working on developing single-pointed concentration? Because I think most people here have spent a little bit of time doing that. Have you noticed any benefits in your real life experience?
So for me, just working on serenity didn't bring a whole lot, I would say, but in the practices of Kriya Tantra, where they have the method of vase breathing or binding the vitality and exertion, that really jump-started my ability to focus. Mm-hmm. And I think why that worked for me is because my mind gets pretty bored with just... serenity, you know.
Right.
But if I have something that I'm attached or connected to, like a deity, and I can stay with that, mm-hmm. then. So I think that's why that works.
Nice. Yeah.
So a while back, when I was practicing concentration more, I was surprised to find that when people were telling me things, like giving me a lot of information all at once for a long duration, I could really focus on it. And I didn't get a headache, and I understood what they were saying, and it was easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't experienced that before, but I really think it was due to that practice.
Yeah, it reminds me of my nephew when he was like 12. He learned how to meditate online. It made it easier for him to do his homework. He had better concentration. Self-taught. Then he wanted to learn how to do, like, I can't remember, moving things from a distance. He probably wanted to start bending spoons or something next. Anyone else? Yeah.
I know just in retreat, when we're in silence and we have so many meditation sessions a day, and I'm doing a little bit of, you know, trying to generate a little more concentration, I just find that I can see what's happening in my mind much more clearly, both on and off the cushion.
Right.
And right now I'm just having so many, like, songs from a long time ago coming up in my mind. You know, just it just seems like you kind of dig deeper and you find all this junk.
But the clarity goes up naturally when we do retreat from so much less talking. It just helps us tremendously. Life is less distracting. Every moment is less. Yeah.
This morning I experienced my very first more than 30 seconds of concentration. It was wonderful. In fact, it was a long whole session of it. And this isn't in life, but during that session, I had no pain, no awareness of my knees, my legs. It was the most wonderful thing. So, yeah, it just made me float really for the rest of the day.
Oh, you were buoyant.
Yeah, I was very buoyant.
It comes up later, but I'll say it now, that I love, it's hard to understand, but I love Lama Tsongkhapa's section on serenity in the Lama Rinpoche. And I studied it for this, two parts of it. And he just has so much experience. And he talks about, even when you first start working on concentration, you might not be aware of it, but some level of pliancy starts to develop. And that could be an instance of that, where I'm not saying you've developed pliancy, but you have things that lead to it. You know, we have things where some things get a little easier, and he talks about that. But he also says it's quite subtle, and we oftentimes don't see it. So that should be encouraging. Yeah.
I get a lot of really good cleaning done during retreat because all of a sudden my mind is more clear, and usually I want my desk cleared off and clean out my drawers just in the breaks. That's a nice benefit. Actually, I'm involved with Buddhism because I started with concentration. I did Vipassana retreats and Goenka retreats. And so one of the very clear qualities I could see is that there is less affliction when the mind is concentrated. After the first Goenka retreat, I came home to my car had been totaled. Someone had come around a corner and just totaled it. And it was very nice. I just said, oh, it's just a car. That wouldn't have happened in an ordinary situation.
Yeah. So much more calmness in the mind. And you can actually use serenity or concentration to get away from afflictions. There was a meditation that Tenzin Katsuo taught at DFF years and years ago that I did quite a bit. And it was from Ken McLeod's book, and it talked about like when something comes up in the mind, you can either have it take over your mind like it's expressing itself, or you can kind of repress it in an unhealthy way, but you also can be aware of it. And I found by doing that meditation that being aware of it, there were times where I would choose to actually, okay, I recognize what this is, but it was so hard for me to control my mind that it would go into really strong emotions about it. And so I would actually use concentration to get away from it just so I could get my mind calm. I feel like a 2-year-old that needs to get put in a timeout. I need to get away from this for a while so that I can let my mind settle enough. So not that I'm going to suppress it unhealthily and never think about it again, but just so I can get away from it so I can come back with a calm, with a mind that can actually deal with things. And I actually think that that's one of the greatest benefits I have from working on concentration is being able to choose to have enough control of the mind to choose not to think about something, maybe, and to put my mind on something else. If I get into it, I'll tell you a story when we get to this other part, but I might not, I don't know. I'll wait till I get there. Okay, so now we're going to get a little bit more following the text. And the first thing that Venerable does in this chapter is she kind of talks about the subject matter, puts it in contact kind of generally. She talks about the higher training and concentration and says that's discussed in terms of the fourth noble truth, the true path. And then there's the perfection of meditative stability, which is explained in the context of the six perfections that are done with the bodhicitta motivation. And let's see. And so in both contexts, they have, both of those contexts have the same topics, actually. And they're discussed together in this chapter, or in the book. I'm not sure if they're all discussed in this chapter. But the four main topics that both of those have, no matter which context you're in, are conducive conditions for cultivating serenity, the observed objects, the techniques to deal with hindrances and faults, and the attainments of serenity. So those are common to both. And then she talks about, gets a little bit more in terms of what are these terms? What is concentration, which is samadhi, is the Sanskrit. And what is serenity, shamatha? And first she talks about concentration and kind of compares it to how we use the word in daily life, like I have to concentrate to drive a car, versus in religious practice where we're doing this serenity meditation where the mind is going to be focused and absorbed unwaveringly on one object. It's quite a different thing. If you were working on serenity meditation while you're driving your car, you'd probably kill yourself. You can't be single-pointedly concentrating on one thing while you're driving a car, but you are concentrated when you drive a car. It's a different use of the word concentration. But then when you get into Buddhist practice, also the word concentration or samadhi has can vary in meaning. And here she talked about four contexts. The first was the Eightfold Path, and there it's referring to single point and concentration, and it's leading us to states of the jhanas or dhyanas. And then she talked about it in terms of the three higher trainings of ethics, concentration, and wisdom. Those have to do with the Eightfold Noble Path, where right mindfulness, right effort, and right concentration come together. There, the emphasis is more on developing skill in meditation in general, and also dealing with our conduct in daily life, keeping the mind focused on virtue. So it's also used in that way. It's also used in the study of Lohrig, the mind and awareness. It's one of the five object ascertaining mental factors. So one of the mental factors that are always present, that we always have. And when you realize an object, these five factors are present. They're not always present. They're always there when you realize an object. They're what ascertain. And they have different translations, but they're sometimes listed as aspiration, appreciation, mindfulness, concentration, and intelligence. And so when you realize an object, those are present. And how does this happen? These mental factors, they aid your mind in ascertaining an object. They distinguish different features about or specific characteristics about an object that you're contemplating. So this is then explained in the context of serenity here, so I thought it was a nice time to bring this in. So aspiration, which is also called desire to act, or zeal or yearning, this ascertains what's desirable in the object. So it seeks it. It's the basis for joyous effort. And so like with what we just talked about with this faith that we have, that faith leads you to kind of have aspiration or yearning. Then appreciation, the second of the five object ascertaining mental factors, is also translated as belief or resolve. So this ascertains what has been understood as valuable. So you've seen the benefits, right? And now you see this as valuable. So it keeps the mind from being captivated by something else that maybe isn't so valuable. So that's very helpful for us because we easily get off track. The third one is mindfulness. That ascertains what has to be borne in mind. It's the non-forgetting of the object. And this is what causes us to have non-distraction. When we're mindful, we're not distracted. And then concentration or stabilization, samadhi. It's a distinct mental factor. It's capable of dwelling one-pointedly on bearing the same aspect for a sustained period of time on a single imputed object. And then there's this intelligence or wisdom or knowledge, prajna. which is another distinct mental factor. Its function will discriminate precisely with analysis the qualities, faults, or characteristics of an object that you're holding by mindfulness. So we have actually all of these, but we haven't developed them. So this is what we're trying to do. And in terms of concentration, when we develop our concentration, that's the basis for developing insight. So it's important to understand that whatever is serenity is necessarily the mental factor of concentration. And whatever is insight is necessarily the mental factor of intelligence or wisdom. So this comes up later when we talk about the objects too. So the next context that she talked about concentration in was other. Just other. There are other special meditations for special activities. And I actually think what you were speaking out about is one of those. That she didn't list all these things, but I think that would be there's many things where there's many samadhis that you can develop. Concentration is a very broad term. But what does this samadhi do? It unifies your primary mind, your main consciousness, with these associated mental factors so that they're balanced. And so your mindfulness and your attention then on the object can be sustained. And the mind is very tranquil, it's calm, it's gentle. And so it's more like a mirror. And this is what Venerable Nawang was talking about, where things are reflected easier because the mind is more there in these ways. We have a better balance of mindfulness, attention, concentration, all these things. And so when you can combine a mind like that with wisdom, you can come to a deep understanding, which is why we need concentration. It's like the powerhouse of the mind in a way. And this is very different from when we're distracted, our usual kind of like flittering mind that jumps from one thought to another, gets us in trouble, is overwhelmed by emotions sometimes. It can get scattered. It can only sometimes go superficially into things. It can't stay enough to like penetrate things, and it's often associated with afflictions. So that's why having the ability to concentrate your mind is so helpful, because you can get away from your afflictions. His Holiness has written a lot about getting away from the conceptual mind. He teaches a lot on looking at the mind as an object for this reason, because we need to get away from conceptuality, to get away from afflictions, to give our mind a break. I mean, that's essentially what he's saying in a nutshell. So then, in summary, serenity is a kind of concentration that arises from meditation. It's accompanied by the bliss of mental and physical pliancy. And so now the mind will abide without effort and without fluctuation on an object for as long as we wish. That's pretty amazing. Next thing in the chapter, it goes into different kinds of advice and cautions, and there were a number of them. The first one had to do with, for beginners, how you first get kind of like a little bit of calm and a little bit of concentration, and you think you have serenity, and then you get disappointed later because you're just as distracted as ever, you know, that can happen. Or another thing that people can try to do is they can try to recreate wonderful meditative experiences. That's a real losing proposition. You will just get frustrated. It doesn't work that way. It actually interferes. Whatever caused you to have that experience, if you try to recreate it, you're usually doing something that's not going to allow that to happen. So don't bother to try. It's more important as advice is to develop a really deep and broad understanding of the Buddhist path in general. Venerable always teaches the Buddhist worldview so that you can place meditation in context, and serenity in particular, and concentration in context. I remember when I first learned to meditate, I was a teenager. I was self-taught for decades, and I had no clue what meditation was about, what it was for, what I was doing. I'm only lucky that I started with some good books, so I didn't get way... I wasn't starting to bend spoons, taking up interest in... Oh, yeah, that's the word, telekinesis. That's what my my nephew wanted to learn about, can you do telekinesis? we have to, we're doing ourselves a big disservice if we try to cultivate serenity to get like psychic powers, which we might, if we don't have any context for having this powerful mind, we could misuse it and harm people, which has happened, and then you're creating a bunch of destructive karma. Or if you're doing it to be famous, or just to be in a blissful state. I know even when I moved here, I still had this influence from the 60s and 70s and the drug culture, really, of like peak experiences, you know, and even in athletics, you know, that euphoria of endorphins and all that stuff. Even when I moved here, I had an interest somewhat. My meditation was kind of contaminated by wanting certain kinds of experiences. And I realized, oh, this is just like you're looking for a high here. That's really, well, actually now I'm more interested in a peaceful state than a high, but maybe that's just aging. But that's not going to help. It's not going to get you anywhere. We need to use this concentration in order to become liberated and fully awakened. That's the goal. And so otherwise, we could just become tempted to remain in a very peaceful state. We become attached to it. And I wanted to bring in something I read from Santikaro, because I'm studying Buddhadasa this winter for my retreat, and he was the translator. And he said something that I thought was kind of interesting about this attachment. He says, attachment is a long-established habit for most of us. If we could drop it easily, we would have become Buddhas just like that. But instead, most of us cling. We have to work at letting go of our attachments and the habit of clinging and grasping. And then he describes this, which it made me think of this liking this blissful state, but he goes beyond that. He says, we begin by letting go of our coarse attachments, attachment to the body, to its aches and pains, attachment to agitation and impatience, to boredom and laziness, to external disturbances and petty annoyances, all these things we let get in our way because we're attached to them not being there, you know, so we get aggravated. Then we find ourselves becoming attached to more subtle things like happy feelings. And then once we let go of that, we discover attachments to higher, brighter, clearer, refined states of awareness. So then letting go of those, we begin to have some insight into reality and we become attached to the insights. Finally, we learn to let go of everything. We successfully let go of more and more subtle attachment till there's nothing, no attachment left at all. I thought that was funny because I kind of see that. I realized 1 year, it was a long time ago, where I realized, oh, I could become attached to a pencil. Like, I like this pencil. Why do you take my pencil? No, it's just crazy. Another caution is that this happens a lot, apparently. I wouldn't know, but people confuse the bliss of serenity and the absence of manifest afflictions, and that's the great thing I actually like about it, is when you can get your mind to settle on something, you get away from your afflictions. But they confuse that with liberation. They have very deep samadhis, apparently, and both Buddhist and non-Buddhist practitioners get confused in this way, and that, you know, it doesn't sustain itself. It's just temporary. In fact, it reminds me of my friend Linda Waterfall had this teacher, a Hindu teacher, who did meditation for 2 years. He came out, the first thing he did was get angry and yell at somebody. So he actually quit talking after that. He never spoke after that. He wrote on a chalkboard. He wrote a lot of books that were out in the 80s. He was a very interesting man. And I could see that, you know, like you just kind of, like we've heard some stories, like some lama said to Venerable Children, yeah, person just came out of a 3-year retreat, completely the same, you know. Same. Yeah, we don't want to do that. We don't want to get sidetracked either. So this is important to have the proper motivation, and it has to be strong and clear. And one thing I like is something I read. I use this little thing from Jin Lam Rinpa, he says, when he's setting his motivation, and I do this in my practice, may the unmistaken realization of shamatha swiftly arise in the stream continuum of my being. He makes a big notion about unmistaken. And then I add to that, and may I do that for the benefit of sentient beings developing bodhicitta. But unmistaken realization of shamatha swiftly arise in the stream continuum of my being. Because we can get it wrong. So we need to, one of the advices they give is make sure that we're checking our meditative experience with our qualified spiritual mentor and follow their advice. This is how we'll be able to realize our aspirations. Otherwise, we might, you can go off into tangents. I know here I've gone off into some tangents for long periods of time. And then I finally, Venerable, or Kenzer Jampa, Kenzer Wangduk, finally explain something, and I realize, oh, this is where this fits on the path. This is not something I even need to think about right now. I was like going down this alley and just going to stay there for a long time, and he helped me to see, no, you're not doing, that's not the place for that. I couldn't figure out how the puzzle fit together. So we need a lot of study, a lot of learning from good teachers. So what we're trying to do with all of this is to get to the place where we realize emptiness. That's the actual counterforce for our afflictions and all their seeds and latencies. And then we want to be able to understand emptiness correctly and then keep our mind focused on it for great lengths of time. So we need the concentration serenity to do that. So that's that part. And then the next thing in this chapter was the six conditions for that are conducive to developing serenity. And I thought the most interesting thing, I'm just going to list them and we'll talk about that a little bit. I gave a question on that, but it was interesting to me that she pointed out right at the beginning of this chapter in Sutrayana, the single point in concentration, you use a coarse mental consciousness. So that means it's related to the body. So that means that these external factors are quite important for serenity because we're using a more coarse mental consciousness. So altitude, temperature, time of day, physical health, all of these things will influence our ability to meditate, which is why we need these conducive circumstances. So it's actually ideal to have all six of these. And even if we're not doing a serenity retreat, it's helpful to have as many of these as we can because they do help us develop concentration. And I find personally what I like about this topic is like I like to think about our life here that we should be focusing on these six because these will help us in our practice. So I'll just list them and then we'll talk about them. I asked a question. So the six are a favorable place. And then before we go into a strict retreat, we need clear and correct understanding of the instructions. There's a lot to learn and read about serenity. Being free of coarse desires and having few desires. When she wrote this section, she combined it with the master Ziyi, the Chinese master. And he said that even if we are in a secluded place, if we crave things, our mind is going to be constantly distracted. So he said you have to get rid of the five sense objects of desire, sights, sounds, taste, touch, all that. Because they captivate and distract the mind. So you can even be in a secluded place and you can still just have your mind fixated on things that are going to make it impossible for your concentration and your practice to progress. That's the third one, being free of coarse desires and having few desires. And then a mind that's satisfied and content, not always wanting more and better. Then our involvement with world activities has to be minimal. So we have to get rid of responsibilities and get rid of the busyness of our ordinary lives. We have to put those things aside. And then have pure ethical conduct. So any precepts or commitments that we have, we need to uphold those. And by doing that, we eliminate regret and remorse. But at a minimum, if you don't have a lot of precepts or whatever, you need to let go of the 10 destructive actions. If you can't let go of those, it's going to be hard to make progress because you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot. you'll have distractions and karmic obstacles coming up, and then you'll have difficulty achieving serenity. So I asked the question to y'all. During winter retreat, we have a greater proportion of these six conditions. So I was interested to know what you feel is or think is, what part are you responsible for in creating these conditions? For example, how are you cultivating contentment? What obstacles do you encounter and how do you work with them? So I actually really think it's important for us to think about these six things in our life here in general. And so I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on what your responsibility is to do this for yourself and how you might have done that. Yeah.
I've been really careful about going online, and I've been intentionally turning off my Wi-Fi so that I have to have a moment of like, okay, do I want to go online? And yeah, really just trying to use it just to go for teaching, listening to teachings, and not, or check the weather. I'm like, okay, those are the two things I'm allowing myself to look at. And it's been nice, kind of really keeping the mind focused.
Nice. Yeah, getting rid of all this business that just pulls the mind away and helps, allows you to have more attention to what you want. Did you have something?
I think because we become more sensitive in retreat, I feel it's my responsibility to do my chores on chore day, because that really has an impact on people's, you know, perceptions of how things look. And also the other thing I'm really working on, just because it's in my face and I have to, is accepting what's going on with my body. And for a long time, for maybe the first 3 weeks, I was rejecting what was going on because I didn't want it. I didn't like what was going on. And that certainly made my suffering more intense. And so now I've accepted the fact this is going to be a long process. Then I've settled down.
Good. Yeah, it's tough.
So when I read this question, what came into my mind was just the process of how we get into retreat, and how, since some of us have done many of them, then I kind of have a notion of how it's going to go at first, and then in the middle, and then at the end. Mm-hmm. And so I don't kind of get ahead of myself or have unrealistic expectations. Mm-hmm. And for me, the first one is to slow down my busy mind. Mm-hmm. And however long that takes, that's the first thing. And so I kind of focus on that first. And then, you know, we'll tackle another, whatever they are. The hardest one for me is all the sense stuff. Mm-hmm. That's the hardest one. It's much easier. Like if I go to a retreat somewhere else and I don't have any understanding of what they serve and how they do it and all of that, I'm just a guest. It's so much easier. There's too much home in this place, you know, in my mind.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody working on contentment?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. So externally, I've used the Buddha Hall as sort of a way to develop a little more contentment around food and drink. In that, when we have these short breaks, you know, do I want to spend 5-7 minutes walking back to Chenrezig, or do I want to stay here and circumambulate and drink water and go use the restroom? And I'm finding it to be a really helpful container for practice. And I'm thinking, if I can stay in the Buddha Hall, I'll be good. If I, you know, of course, you know, I'll go to Chenrezig, but. Yeah, so I'm just seeing that the way it's designed, that we don't have a tea counter and a snack counter, it is very conducive to stay in the practice. So that's what I'm doing externally, not always successfully, but it's my aspiration. And then internally, I've been looking at precious human life and death, and I was thinking that's related here, because in both of those, well, precious human life, appreciating what I have instead of craving more and better, and death, recognizing that wanting more and better doesn't do any good in the long run.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, the next thing in the chapter is Venerable goes into the types of meditation, which are stabilizing and analytical. So stabilizing is what we use primarily to develop serenity, and analytical is what we use for insight. And the one thing that I think surprises people sometimes is the object is not different. It doesn't have to be different. It's not the object that makes it one or the other. It's how the mind engages with the object. So with serenity, we're focusing on the object one-pointedly. It's a mind that's going to develop a lot of stability and this vibrant mental clarity. And then with insight, it analyzes the object deeply to understand the characteristics. And then the next section is observed objects, which I thought I was just not going to spend much time on, and I really surprised myself. I spent the majority of my time working on this section. I used to always find this kind of just bunch of words, and I was going to skip it. Then I ended up being kind of a big, well, I don't know, it just changed. So I'm going to ask this question first, because it, and then my third question, and then we'll go into this, because one of the objects has to do with purifying our behaviors. But the question I asked, my third question, is one of the topics. So we'll start with the question. And that is, without being able to control our coarse physical and verbal actions, which are motivated by coarse afflictions, we will not succeed in pacifying mental factors that prevent concentration. So have you identified behaviors that are not well controlled and the motivating afflictions? And you don't have to describe in any detail unless you want. You can talk very generally. I have some. But so it's important for us. I think this is an important question. Unless we can learn to see what is getting in our way, we actually are not going to be able to develop serenity. I mean, you can maybe be lucky and just start with the Buddha, like they say, but they teach, every book has this, everyone has this topic. I found it in every book I looked at because I was trying to figure out this one aspect of something that was confusing me here. And it's there. And it just became more and more kind of dawned on me how this is important for us to understand. Like, what is getting in our way is a kind of maybe a way to think about it. So, yeah. Anyone have anything to say? Brave souls. Yeah.
I've become more aware of, I guess, uncontrolled facial expressions, expressing my usually irritation or dislike on something that just, yeah, kind of being aware of like, oh, I just gave, yeah, raised my eyebrows or did some sort of facial expression expressing my dislike in something. Mm-hmm. So.
Maybe another way to ask this question is, when you work on serenity, what gets in your way? You know, like when you think about it in terms of the five hindrances, those are, it's a little, I'm asking kind of the same question, but some of these things actually are so strong in us that they lead to behaviors.
What has been noticeable more in this retreat is the ruminating thoughts, both when it's, you know, more of the like aversion or attachment, but the mental chatter is so loud because we're more quiet with our voice, and it definitely gets in the way of trying to concentrate either in meditation or outside of it.
So is it like the proliferation of thoughts, would you say?
Yeah. Either the... I'd say the storyline of both things, you know, if there's something that is irritating me, I am assigning motivation and assuming that I actually know what happened behind the scenes, what someone else did or was thinking that, you know, is stimulating my irritation, or if it's more, you know, an object of attachment of like, you know, how am I going to get what I want? And what's that going to look like? The proliferating thoughts that really aren't based in reality.
Yeah.
So I think for me, pacifying mental factors is kind of the entryway in retreat for me. And my stock phrase is, this is my mind and I'm the only one responsible for how my moments are, something like that. And so I don't let my awareness jump out to other things. So it's me and I'm the one that gets to, and I put it that way, that I get to get out of where I'm going because it's going to bring some misery or, you know, it's not going to end well. So kind of like that. And that works pretty good, I would think. Yeah.
Okay. Let's go into the topic and see if you can see where we go. Okay. So these observed objects, that's what you're putting your mind on when you're focusing your mind. So once we've gotten to the place where we've addressed our laziness and our procrastination, and we actually start the training in serenity, we have to identify and establish an object of meditation that we'll use. So obviously they're talking here about doing a strict retreat, right? But we can apply this to our meditation practice in certain ways. So the Buddha taught many different objects because sentient beings have different tendencies and different dispositions. So there were several objects that were described for cultivating serenity. And so it's said that in general, you could use both an external or an internal object, like even a corpse or a casino, right? But it's not the physical thing that we're developing concentration on, it or serenity. It's the conceptual appearance in our mind, because when we're working on serenity, we're working with the mental consciousness, not the sense consciousness. When you read in the Pali Canon, those corpse meditations really carefully, they went and looked at the corpses. The Buddha told them, don't go so that when you're leaving or coming, you don't, the wind of the corpse isn't blowing at you because it's so disagreeable. Go the other way, but remember all the scenery and everything, you remember it all, and then you go back and you sit on your cushion. It's mental. It's the mental. These are conceptual appearances. It's not sitting there looking at the corpse. And so this is like staring at a candle or even a corpse. That won't lead to serenity because that's the visual consciousness and it's not considered stable. And it's not always functioning, right? So it is true that staring at an external object may drive away discursive thoughts, but that alone won't constitute serenity. And I was interested in that because I actually have used that to some success. And I can think of two times when I was really highly emotional to a degree that was overwhelming me. And once I ran out into the woods, and once I was sitting in a circle in, with all of you, and I was just like over the top with my emotion. One was like when we heard about Geshe-la's death. I had not prepared myself to sit in a circle with others and learn that. Not at all. And I was so upset. And what I did is what I've done before, and this works for me, is I just stared at this prayer flag. I mean, sometimes when you have anger on board, the mind has so much energy, if you can direct that and put it on just an object and use all of that energy and just focus on that object, you can get away from it for a while. And that's exactly what I did, and it took me a long time to finally get my mind settled enough that I could think, oh, she's trying to help us. I was like, it really wasn't working for me. I needed some time alone to kind of come to terms with that. And I remember another time I was quite upset about something. It was when we were building the shanty cabin. Very unfortunate thing happened the day before I went to Taiwan. And it was a very rough day. And I remember I went out in the woods. I was crying and I was stared at a piece of grass until my mind settled down, and it took quite a while. And then I came back, and I felt really kind of humiliated. And Venable said to me, "Oh, your practice is working so well for you." I'm just like, "If you knew what I just did." And she said, "No." I'm like, "Okay, whatever." Anyway, but then when reading Tsongkhapa, it's interesting because he has experienced a lot and he writes about it well. He said this about this: the benefit of concentration that hasn't yet achieved serenity, that would be what I'm talking about here. Thus, without having achieved pliancy, even when mindfulness is not continually maintained, your mind can automatically become non-discursive. That's what was happening. Like, I need to stop these thoughts or I'm going to go nuts. And you can integrate, and that kind of activity that you're doing, that level of concentration, which is some level, you can integrate that with your activities of moving, walking, lying down, and sitting. And he calls that an approximation of concentration. Is called one-pointed mind of the desire realm. I thought that was a good description. So I think I have experienced this being useful, so I think there's something to that. And the reason I think I was able to do that, because I do work on concentration some every day, so I'm doing something. And every once in a while, it turns out to be helpful. Like when I'm going bonkers. So basically, we get familiar with an object, say an external object like a kasina, which is a colored disc, or an image of the Buddha. You look at it with your visual consciousness, and then you lower your eyes and you meditate on it with the mental consciousness. And this internal image is a conceptual appearance, and that's the observed object. And this is where I kind of went off into all these other books because of one thing that was said about this, but let me go on first. This thing about it being a conceptual appearance, kind of like, this has been a question I've had for a long time. It started when I used to always do turning the mind to look at the mind. One year I did this retreat and I got to the end of the retreat and I thought, I think I got the whole thing wrong. It just felt so permanent. And then I thought about this for a long time and I answered my question this time. It is a permanent object that you're looking at when you're doing concentration. You're looking at a conceptual appearance. It is a permanent object. I don't know what I was doing during that retreat, but I did answer the question. So meditation does begin as a conceptual process that is training your mental consciousness. It's not training a sensory consciousness. We're using the mental consciousness. But a non-conceptual meditation with the mental consciousness is actually only possible once you've hit the path of seeing, because you need to have that level. And this is where I had confusion around this, because it's the stuff that we learn in Lohrig, where about mental direct perceivers, and you know, like when you a sensory object, you have a moment of a mental consciousness, but after that, it's all conceptual. And so, really, when we're doing serenity meditation as an ordinary, without those level of realizations, it's conceptual. You're using a conceptual appearance. That's quite clear. So maybe that doesn't interest you, but it took me a long time to get clear on that. And then Alex Burson explains it very detailed, which I won't bother with. So there are four main categories that the Buddha talked about of observed objects. And this seems like just a bunch of words. It used to feel that way to me, but actually it's not that hard. And although there are a lot of words, but it's actually quite easy concepts. The first are extensive. That's the word she uses in this chapter. It's also called universal or pervasive objects. The second is objects of purifying your behavior. The third are objects of expertise. And the fourth are objects for purifying afflictions. And so these, all meditation objects fit into those four categories. So we'll talk about the first one, these extensive objects of meditation. And there are four of those. But it's actually not that complicated. The first two are analytical and non-analytical images. So basically, these are described, now it's describing objects from the side of the observer. How are you looking at this object? How are you engaging it? One could be as an analytical way, or one could be as a non-analytical image. So one is using insight, one is using concentration or serenity that focuses on an object without analyzing it. So thus you have analytical images and non-analytical images. So these two types of images are appearances to your mind. It's not a specifically characterized object. It's not an external thing. It's not something out there. It's not the gong. So the way it works in analytical meditation, we first mentally construct an analytical image by thinking about something. So say if you meditate on the Four Noble Truths, the image isn't something out there. It's actually an object that belongs to the mind. The mind analyzes the object. It looks into the qualities, the details, and it creates a concept that way, conceptual appearance. And then these non-discursive or non-analytical images, they're also called non-discursive. Geshe Sopa explained this way. In contrast, non-discursive or non-analytical images are byproducts or mental derivatives of non-analytical thought. Those are the objects of serenity. And I was like, what? Why don't they just say conceptual appearance or meaning generality or some other term for that? But they don't. They use this other term, which is why it took me forever to figure out what was going on. And it's really that simple. Alex Berzin explains it in more depth with the appearing object and this and that. But it's really that simple. It comes down to it's a conceptual appearance. And they're just kind of talking about it in a different way. So what Venerable Chodron says, more simply stated, serenity is a single-pointed meditation without analysis. The mind is merely focused on an object. It becomes stabilized. And the mental image of the object appears to the mind. It's like a reflection. So that's that. So when you might ask, well, of these images, these analytical, non-analytical images, what are they images of? Actually, they're images of the other three categories. That's why it's like one of these things where it's just a word. Why I was so confused before until I dug into this. It's like, you know how Venerable explains how they do their outlines in Tibetan Buddhism, where the whole outline will be contained in the first object of the outline. You know, they do it in a confusing way. That's what this is. It's a way of describing objects. And what objects are they? The next three in the category, basically. It's how you're interacting with them. But still, talking about this first category of extensive objects, that's the first two were the kind of appearances to the mind. That was from the side of the subject. The other two are the next one is from the side of the observed object. This is called the limits of existence. Basically, there are two types. There's the diversity of phenomena and the nature of phenomena. It's basically boiling down to the diversity of phenomena is encompassing all that exists, and the nature is about how it exists. They're just kind of explaining things in a way. Does that make any sense? It's like this first category of extensive objects is just kind of telling you, here's how they exist from the side of the subject. Here's how they exist from the side of the object. There are things that exist, and then there's the way they exist. Things that exist are the diversity of phenomena. The way they exist are the limits of the nature of phenomena. That's everything is included in that. Everything is empty, right? So that's its limit. So here's a way you could say it more easily. For the diversity of phenomena, just this is all there is. There's nothing more. It's the limit of it. All these things are existence. That's all this is. It's just saying that's all it's saying. And the limits for the nature of phenomena, it could be expressed saying, this alone is how things exist. They do not exist in any other way. So they just have this category where they're talking about things from the side of the subject and the side of the object. And then the fourth category is, again, is one called the limits for the diversity. Oops. Is the purpose that we seek to accomplish it. So now they're talking in terms of the result. Because we haven't yet talked about, like, somebody who's gotten, is having serenity and they have results, right? So it's, you've gained the fruit of serenity or insight, and what you're focusing on is the object that you're observing, but now it's from the perspective of final attainment, right? So they're just kind of making this broad category of everything. All objects are going to fit into those four. So I don't think I explained that so well, but it's not that hard. It's just hard to speak about, maybe. Okay, let's go on. Okay, so with either serenity or insight, you direct your attention to the object, you stabilize on it, you become accustomed to it, and by repeated practice, you become free of these dysfunctional tendencies. And that helps you to have actual transformation. And that's how you realize these goals, the purpose that we accomplish. You have to get rid of these dysfunctional tendencies. So what really are those? These are the seeds or predisposing latencies for afflicted karma. These things also are these latencies that make it hard to use the body and mind in order to practice the path. They sustain and increase our afflictions. So we have these latencies in the mind. They get in the way. When you work on concentration, you can get rid of them temporarily because your concentration is so strong that you're suppressing them. When you have insight, you get rid of them from the root. You're free of them in a more permanent way because you've got insight that destroys them from the root. So basically, this group, these extensive objects, is just another way about talking generally about these objects of meditation. It's not a set of special objects that's distinct from the other three. It's just a way of talking about them. That makes sense. Okay, it's kind of not that much there, really. But there are a lot of words, and it takes a long time to say them. Now we get more into what we actually are doing. In a way. So this is the one that I thought, you know, it's good for us to learn about. And you just don't pick your object out of the air when you're going to do a serenity retreat. You know, if you work on the five hindrances, you learn something. And this first group, this set of objects, is for a particular kind of person. It's recommended for those whose behavior is dominated by a specific affliction. If you're dominated by a specific affliction, you should go to this group. If you're not, you actually don't need to go to this group. But if you are, you kind of need to, or you're not going to get anywhere. That's basically what every text said that I read about this. The affliction is one that we've been so familiar with over lifetimes that it's now predominant in our mind. And so because of that, they teach these five objects, because this is the affliction that disturbs your mind the most. If you don't have one predominant one, you can choose any of these, but you don't have to. You can use even other things. But if you really have something that dominates, if you have behaviors that are dominating your life, those are based on afflictions, and you need to, these are the objects you need to go to figure out what to do. So these ones we're quite familiar with, actually. So if we want to counteract strong desire, we cultivate concentration or serenity on certain objects, right? We look at the ugly aspect of the person or thing that we're attached to. I like to think of it sometimes, you know, they talk about the 32 or the 36 body parts or a corpse, whatever. But basically, we get attached to a lot of things. We have desire for a lot of things. So you have to think about it in terms of looking for the unattractive aspect of whatever it is. It might be that you're some situation that somebody else has that you really want, you really desire something, like, I've got to go to India, I've got to do this. I'll never be happy without it. But then when you really look at it, like, you got to look at not just what you're coloring it with your attachment, but you've got to look at the different aspects. In particular, to counteract the desire, you've got to look at the unattractive aspects, or if it's a physical thing like a person, the ugly aspects, like the parts of the body. I mean, it's really hard to want to, I don't know, if I spit on your food, do you really want to eat it? No. I mean, it's like that. The body is foul, including the spit. So, but what you do is that would be your object, and then you keep your attention on it. Or maybe you're a person who has anger or resentment or animosity, and that dominates your life in a way. Then you need to work on love. You need to actually develop love for friends, strangers, enemies, all of them. You have to do that. And it has to be at the level of meditative equipoise. You want to provide all of them with help and happiness. So here, love is referring both to the subjective experience within you, but it's also an object because it's beings, right? And so this kind of love includes equanimity because your love is equally applying to everyone, anyone and everyone. And your consciousness becomes that attitude. And then if you have confusion to dominate your mind, and there are many kinds of confusion or ignorance, the most important one is the view of the personal identity, right? But the thing that you need to concentrate on then is dependent arising. And here they gave two examples in our book. One was the 12 links, because this is the dependent arising process that creates cyclic existence, and it's how we get out. And you come to see that there's actually no person. It's just these causes and results, causing results. There's no person there who's like, I'm in three, now I'm going to four, now I'm in six, I'm headed to existence, seven. No, there's no person there. It's just this process. And then you can also look at everything that exists in the past, present, and future is dependent on causes and conditions. Everything is dependent in that way. And so apart from these mere causes and conditions, there's actually no performer of the actions. There's no experiencer of their results. So you want to, if you're trying to do something that gets at the personal view of a personal identity and you have a confusion about that, you work on dependent arising in these ways. And then the fourth of the fifth is the conceit or pride. And, you know, this is the one where they talk about the five aggregates or the 12 sources, the 18 constituents or the six elements. You look at all this detail and diversity, and these are actually difficult to understand. So that actually helps the mind of pride. But I think the bigger thing here is not so much the difficulty of understanding them. It's actually that these kind of images, if you focus on these and you understand them, when you look at, you're just looking at these components, it helps you dissolve this sense of thinking that you're an independent, absolute, substantial person separate from these parts. There's just all these components out there. There's no person. Because, you know, one of the things with pride is it's usually based on ignorance. So you're kind of going at the ignorance and the pride in one kind of both at once. So you focus your intention on those and hold it there. And I will talk about that a little bit more below, further. And then the fifth one is the one I do the most, is distracting, distortive thoughts. I think really I have a lot of restlessness, and that's why I like that so much. And then your object to work on is inhalation, the breath, inhalation and exhalation of the breath. So these are the objects that are taught in terms of purifying behaviors. Mine, I would say, is restlessness. So then the third category of the four categories is the objects of meditation for expertise. This one is, I kind of found interesting. And these are really good for us to help us develop insight. These help us, when we can use these objects, say we don't need the other ones. Maybe our behavior is not dominated. if we can use these objects, they will help us have more knowledge. They help to refute the view of a personal self, of a, you know, of an independent self. They help to facilitate realizing emptiness. They increase our concentration and our wisdom. So how, what are the examples? They gave like, I don't know, they gave five examples in this chapter. The first was we develop expertise regarding the five aggregates. And when we do that, we come to know that an I and a mind don't exist separate from the aggregates. Like what Guy Newland said once, if there was an I that was separate from the aggregates, I could email it to you. I'll never forget that. It was so funny. True. Okay. It's merely a dependent phenomena, and it's merely designated upon the dependently arisen composite of parts, the body and the mind, right? Or you can develop expertise on the 18 constituents. And this is a framework for categorizing the elements that make up living beings and the world, kind of everything. And you come to know that these arise dependent on their respective causes and conditions. They're not arising upon independent absolute elements. And then, or you might develop expertise regarding the 12 sources, which is similar to that. From this one, it's a different way of understanding dependent nature of phenomena. And Venerable described that we come to know the six external sources, like the external sources like forms, sounds, smells, tastes. Those are what they call the object condition of consciousness. So how is our consciousness conditioned? It's conditioned by the thing out there. That's the object condition. There's the internal source, the eye faculty, the rods and cones. That's the dominant condition of consciousness. That is what helps to directly produce the consciousness. So those two things together are what these sources, these 12 sources are from the different, you know, eye, ear, nose, you know, the objects of the different faculties, and the objects that they see. And then what do you need? You also need a preceding mind, a consciousness that has just ceased. You need the preceding moment of consciousness. You put those three together, boom, there's something that exists in the world, no matter what it is. This thing I didn't turn on, all kinds of things. And actually, here's an example. For a visual consciousness that perceives a red apple, what do you need? If you're going to do this, what do you need? You need the external source, which is the object condition. That's the apple, that's the color red. You need the internal source, you need the eye faculty, your rods and cones. And you need a preceding moment of consciousness. Boom, then that turns, that perceives the red colored apple. Okay, then fourth one was expertise about the 12 links. So now we see how we get into having suffering, how it arises and how it ceases. And the way to do that is to look at the impermanence, the dukkha, and the selflessness in relation to those. The fifth was expertise about appropriate and inappropriate results. So this is basically talking about karma now. We actually look and see with our own experience that pleasant experience arises from virtuous actions, but not from non-virtuous actions. They can only be unpleasant. And when we understand that topic and we come to a conclusion, then you focus your mind single-pointedly on that. It's just what we do when we do our analytical meditations. You go through the meditation, whether you use it as it's written or whatever, there's a conclusion. And that generates a feeling in you. And then you stabilize on that to help it. If you just go on to the next thing with your restless mind, it won't penetrate. You have to stabilize it. It's like, you know, you've moved on too fast. You have to stay there. So the question came up when Venerable Carter was teaching recently that not much is said about how to like look at these like 18 constituents. But Tsongkhapa talks about this a little bit. And I thought to share that because I did this briefly and I thought it was actually kind of nice. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal, but he did say something. So how do you stabilize your mind in something like the aggregates, you know, that just whiz through those things that we're going to be expert in? How do you do that? So for that one, for the five aggregates, you have to understand that all impermanent phenomena are included within the five aggregates. So you actually look at those five aggregates and you mentally collect them gradually, all these impermanent things into those five. You observe them and you keep your attention on them. And then just as you do with discerning wisdom, where you cultivate differentiation, you cultivate collectedness. You collect them. I found it easier to do with the next one, but let me finish on this one first. You cultivate this sense of collectedness, of putting them together in your mind, and develop concentration on that. So your attention is brought together on the object without moving to other objects. He says this is personal instruction of the knowledge tradition. But then he explained it with the 18 constituents. I found that actually more interesting, to think about everything. There's all these things out there, sights, sounds, taste, touch, all these things, because this is everything that exists, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, mental sense faculty. There's mental consciousnesses, there's mental body tactile consciousnesses, there's all these consciousnesses that are knowing things, right? Including the mental conscious. And there's all these objects that they know, all the sights, sounds, smells, phenomena. But then there's these sensory apparatus that we have, right? The sense faculties for all these six things, for seeing, hearing. I'm being Jeffrey now, tasting. What is it? Touching. Whatever. Smelling, for God's sake. He always does it in the same order. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. He always went through all six every time. So if you think about it and you collect in your mind that there's nothing actually outside of that, and you collect it all in this big heap and then just collect it, put your mind on that. Everything. It's like totality. I'm going to go into Chinese Hongyun Buddhism next. The totality of all. That's as far as I got with it. I liked it, though. I liked the idea of collecting things. You know, like, it did give you a little bit of direction. I mean, you have to spend some time with these things and figure it out. And you have to do research. I'm sure there's probably some more out there. But people actually find it beneficial to do this. And these kind of objects will help us to develop insight. Because really, like, when you do... That's why I like the four establishments of mindfulness. Four is easier than 18. And when you look at those things long enough, you know, there's like, where is the person in there? You just get to a place where, like, you're looking at feeling for days and days and days. Where is the person, right? You look at these different consciousness, where is the person? You look at the mental factors that come up, where is the person? You know, at some point it just dawned on you, not there. No. Anyway, four is easier than 18, so that would be my recommendation. Right. And then the next category is the objects for purifying afflictions. These are general antidotes. And this is the one where they talk about the different realms. Like, if you want to get out of the desire realm, you got to see the disadvantages of it and see the peacefulness of the form realm. If you want to get out of the form realm, you got to see the disadvantages and the coarseness of it, and look at the refinement and the advantages of the formless realms, like that. So when you do that with concentration, you realize you're just temporarily suppressing things. Even a person, you haven't really gotten yourself out of samsara by doing that. But if you do this with insight, when you get to the place of insight, looking at things, then you'll cut things from the root. So, yeah. And that would involve, so like to temporarily suppress afflictions in the form and formless realms, you look at the coarseness of the lower and the peacefulness of the higher levels. But with cutting the root of the afflictions, you meditate on the 16 attributes of the Four Noble Truths. and you combine serenity with insight on those 16 to go to liberation. So that's basically it. It would make more sense to pick the last one, I would say. Like if you were at that level, I would say personally, well, you do need to develop all these abilities to be a Buddha, but personally speaking, if it was me, I would just let go. I would get to the level of concentration that I need to realize emptiness directly, and I would go right for insight. Do not pass go. Do not collect 200. I wouldn't bother with the formless realms. But if you're going to be a Buddha, you have to be able to do all these things. That's what they say. So then the rest of this chapter I didn't review. She went into other objects, like the conventional nature of mind, a few pages on that, and then mostly a page or less on emptiness, the Buddha, the breath, objects of Tantra, how to choose our object, which I'm hoping tonight helps a little bit to think about, because when you look at all these different objects and you look at what gets in your way, you at least know kind of what book to turn to. And then speaking, and then she talks about structuring a session and then working with the body. And what I would say that I really like Lama Tsongkhapa's chapter on serenity. I found it really hard to read the first time, easier the second time. This time I just looked at parts of it. But he just is so, I mean, he's a yogi. I mean, he is a yogi. And there's Jinla Rinpa's book teaches that book, but it's really much easier to read. And it's a beautiful, shorter book, but it doesn't have all the topics. And then Geshe Sopa's books, you know, describe, go into great detail on this. This book that Venerable's done, I have to say, when I read the five hindrances in this version, I had gotten these chapters like 12 years ago, I'm sure, or more, for these concentration chapters. I read them like crazy years and years and years ago. And I was really surprised when I read what she wrote on the five hindrances. I was like, wow, she has really been using these. It was so beautiful to read. I mean, Venerable writes so clearly about these things. Like, and then if you want to, still want to find something, but you want to spend a lot of time, I look at Alex Burson, but then I have to like retranslate everything he says. I did it for one paragraph, and it took a long time. But I did learn what I wanted to. So those are some good sources. So are there any comments or questions? Yeah.
So it sounds to me, I mean, it's that so many of these objects are analytical meditations, it sounds like. And then you get some insight of some sort. I don't know. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. And you focus on that being your object.
For serenity.
Yes, for serenity. But it's not really identifiable what that object is. It's just a thing.
Love is a great example.
Yeah, I just read through the description of love again today. But what I'm going for is you just analyze until you, with that same object, until you reach the point where you no longer have to analyze to have that feeling arise, and that's your object.
Where you no longer have to analyze to have that feeling arise.
Yeah, okay, so let's forget about love. Let's look at the five aggregates.
If you don't
need
to analyze and you can just have the feeling, just use that if you're working on serenity.
So with the aggregates, same thing. You analyze, and then when you sit down, you go right to the aggregates, and boom, up comes your appearance of whatever it is, and that's your object, right?
I think so, but I have to say for myself, I work more on, when I work on concentration, I work on the breath. And that's now seeming a little bit unfortunate in one way to me, because it's, in order to get to the place of a conceptual appearance, you have to have the nimitta, right?
Right.
So, but I still find this useful for me because I have a lot of restlessness, and it helps me tremendously with my body and with my mind, and it's what I actually need. I'm quite convinced of this. So I'm not quite where Jeffrey is yet, where it's just a tranquilizer for the mind. Well, yeah, he's right, but I need the tranquilizer, right?
Right.
And also the other thing to realize is with doing mindfulness versus serenity, there is a difference there. And I really understood this better when I read, like, this one year when I was doing the Four Establishments, and I got permission from Venable, I read all these Theravadan masters because they're like, they just do this practice so much. She said, yeah, go for it. And I read in this one book, like, oh, the master said, well, if you want to work on Four Establishments of mindfulness and mindfulness, you can be right here in the city with all these distracting noises because it won't interfere. But if you want to work on serenity, you need these conducive circumstances because you need your mind to be one-pointed. So that's talking about a difference. It's not the object, again. You could be using the same object. It's how you're engaging with it. And this is where I think where the best I can answer a question to say is there is a difference between mindfulness that is recalling an object and doing those kind of meditations and then serenity that focuses on them. And they even in the Theravada, reading of the Four Establishments, because I've read it by different masters, including out of the Theravada tradition, you know, some masters will teach first you need concentration, then you work on insight. Some will do insight, then concentration. Some do both together. So there's a lot of different ways that people do this. So I don't know exactly how to answer your question, but you aren't trying to use discrimination to get to serenity, unless you're going for the union of serenity and insight, which right. you actually are.
Yeah.
That's what happens. You're analyzing, and it brings about serenity. But for working on serenity, you want to pick something, which is why I think Venerable teaches the Buddha so much, because it's just like,
it's there.
And there, I think the most important thing, I did do that meditation a lot, and I realized, not as much as others though, but I realized that I made a big mistake for a long time of working on clarity rather than stability. You really, when they say, look at it, analyze it, like kind of get familiar with it, so that's what they mean. They don't mean analyze like you're going for insight, like get familiar with it, close your eyes, create it, and if all you have is a yellow blob, stabilize on that. They weren't kidding. Don't keep trying to create all those parts there, because that you have to have stability first. And I know I made that mistake at one point because I had such trouble getting stability. And so I could see, oh, there is something to that. You really have to do that first. You have to stabilize first. And so I think when they say analyze for serenity, maybe they mean more like they do with the visualized object. You become familiar with it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't know for sure. I have to talk to somebody who knows more. Okay. That's exactly why we need these books and people who have experience.
So my second question then is on using the breath as the object.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a sense object.
Yeah, it is, but not when you're working on serenity. I mean, it gets to the point where Venerable has explained this a few times, where you get to the place where you're using a mental consciousness looking at a nimitta.
Yeah, but the nimitta doesn't arise until you've reached some level of stability, right? A really long time.
I think so.
Yeah. So then using a sense object as the vehicle to induce, or whatever the verb would be, for the nimitta to arise is the way to do it. There's no other way to use the breath, correct?
That's what I understand.
Okay.
But still within that, I have to say that this is why I'm using Buddhadasa. Because one time when I had a long time for retreat some years ago, I used his. And although I ran into trouble because my mind was just too tight, I thought his method would work well for me. And I found it helpful the way he taught. I don't think it will work for everyone. This is where your dispositions really matter. Like, you know, like with many things, like when I run into trouble and I'm too tight, I need to turn to Thich Nhat Hanh. because he'll help me to be more loose. And then when I get too, you know, like too tight or too loose, that's a really hard thing, as Chandra Goman said. And so the way different people teach and their methods seem to be quite different to me too. I did learn for sure, like, you know, this meditation I like where you use the breath coursing through the body. Even Buddhaghosa teaches that from the nostrils to the stomach, calls it tracking or some chasing or following or something. But that is, it's nice because when your mind is all over the place, you need a big object. And the smaller you make the object, the more concentration you need. So if you get like me, who has a, if your mind's getting, is so tight sometimes, if you use too small of an object, like really gave me headaches after this concussion. I could not do certain meditations for a long time because I would just get headaches, right? And so that's why I went to this really big object for a long time. And then I was telling you, now what I was doing for a while was starting 5 minutes with the whole thing, then 5 minutes just with the abdomen, and then finally 5 minutes here, because I could do that without getting headaches, right? Smaller and smaller objects take more attention, and concussions and attention don't seem to go together too well. It impairs your attention, which is why you don't remember things, right? Because you have to attend to things to remember them, which is why when we finally get someplace, we have to stay with it for a while. So I don't know the exact answer to your question, but I do know those things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things that I learned after some years was I used to focus on different Buddha images. Mm-hmm. And I learned after a while that really was not helpful. Yeah. I have to stick with one.
Right.
So I, once I started sticking with one, then things started getting stable.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could start, now I'm at a place where I can bring another one in,
mm-hmm.
and I get it pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So, but for years, I just would do with whatever retreat we were doing and, you know, whatever and whatever mm-hmm. image. And that wasn't helpful for my mind, I will say.
Yeah. What did you learn from using the vase breathing and the other holding? Like, what, how is that beneficial?
They say that it stops the winds.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, the thoughts are mounted on the winds. So if you hold your breath,
mm-hmm.
You know, you bring your lower pelvic floor muscles up and take a breath and swallow and mm-hmm. then put everything at the abdomen and hold that as your, have a mental image of whatever, you know, you're using.
Mm-hmm.
So like now it's Waitara.
Mm-hmm.
And you get very deep in staying with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's quick because, at least for me,
it's
I can't...
It's using, like, the physiology of the body.
Yes, yes.
The subtle physiology yes, yes. of the body.
Yeah, so it stops all of that mm-hmm. busy discursive junk.
Yeah.
So that's what I started with, and then my mind got pretty calm pretty quick.
Yeah. His Holiness teaches publicly the nine
yeah.
breath thing, and
yeah.
I find that helpful, too.
Yes.
You know, it really kind of is a nice way to start because
mm-hmm.
it clears out.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you feel the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. This will probably be the last question. It's getting kind of late.
I'm guessing the answer might be, well, that's just two different things. But listening to your description of the conceptual appearance that we're meditating on, that is therefore a permanent object... When I'm thinking about the Buddha image in particular, that makes sense to me and seems to be intention, at least in my mind, when we describe, such as in just the Shakyamuni Buddha meditation, you know, this is not a statue, this is not a tanka, this is, you know, a living Buddha, this is a real Buddha, which in my mind would not be permanent and static. So I have difficulty holding in my mind a Buddha image that I'm trying to cultivate, you know, some stability on,
mm-hmm.
which seems a very static image, versus once I try to think of it as, okay, but that's a real Buddha. I don't, the in my mind, the Buddha would be dancing around or something. I mean, it's just that's slightly extreme, but that's the difficulty.
It seems like in the practices, you're doing different things at different times with how you engage with things. So at the beginning of a practice, when you visualize the Buddha and refuge field and all that, I would want to feel like I'm in the presence of a being. I would want to engage that way with these visualized objects. But then when you're thinking, when you're getting to a place in the sadhana, like when I do the White Tara sadhana, I have a place where I stop and I do this other thing that I'm working on, because you're making requests for things, right? Well, this is what I'm working on, so help! And so I stop there and I do that, right? But now I'm going to engage with that in a different way. So if I was using a visualized image, then I wouldn't try to feel myself in the presence of a living being with a lot going on. I would just have the image created in my mind and I would focus on that. I mean, it's really what the mind does with it, which is why I think whether things are permanent or not kind of doesn't matter, because we can't see subtly that well. You know what I mean? I mean, I can't. I mean, most of us, we don't have that ability. But what I think matters more is knowing how we're trying to use something in a certain time. Because it's the objects can be the same, but how you're observing them, how you're engaging them, how you're using them can be different. And so I would think about it that way. And I would really separate what you're doing in different parts of the sadhana, because the sadhana to me is like a big play. And you're training your mind. Here's act one. Here's act two. I'm developing these qualities, right? And that's why I love the seven-limb prayer. You got seven acts all in one prayer, you know, and all these different things. And, you know, every retreat, something pops up that stays a lot of times during much of the retreat, that now you're ready to learn something about that. But they still, you got the same acts in every sadhana, really. So, but those are things to get the mind to a place where then, boom, if you're going to work on serenity or you're going to work on something else, you're at that place in the sadhana where you do that. And even within the sadhana, there's, like, if you're saying mantra or whatever you're doing something in a certain way then. Until you study enough and understand the components, it's not as rich. But once you study, it's kind of like people really understand tonkas. Tonkas are like an encyclopedia if you understand enough about them. If you're me, I'm like, pretty nice picture over there. But people who understand the symbolism, it's like an encyclopedia for them. And that's what it is as we understand the different parts of a sadhana and how we're using it to train ourselves. Because we're complex beings, we need a lot of different aspects of our being developed. So it made me think about something I read here. There is one sentence in here that I really don't understand, and it kind of goes to your question, and it's something that Venerable wrote about how stabilizing on this helps to lead to insight, essentially. And I think, why would an object of stability help with insight? Kind of like, that's not 100% clear to me, except for this, that how your mind is engaging with the 18 constituents, for example. You're making a collection. You're not analyzing, looking at the different aspects of them. You're just collecting them. And boom, that's the collection, and now you're looking at the collection. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're looking in an analyzing mind, you're actually analyzing all those things. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a different activity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one thing to put everything in a basket and look at it. It's another thing to figure out the subatomic particles in there and the lack of inherent existence of everything in there.